In this episode, Justine gives a book recommendation to a classic author who's one of my favorites, plus she has an honorable mention. In addition, I have Shane K. Morton to talk about a drag queen. And not just a drag queen that solves murders. I'm Brad Shreve, and you're listening to Queer Writers of Crime, where we feature LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. This week, listeners, I have a special treat for you. Because of technical difficulties, you don't have to listen to me babble on and on at the beginning of the show. Fortunately, Justine's book recommendation was saved, and you'll get to hear it now. I think you probably have a book to share with us.
I do.
Well, I'm on pins and needles to hear about it.
Well, you're going to have to wait a little longer to hear about it, because I've got an honorable mention here. As you know, and maybe as the listeners can guess, I go through a lot of books trying to find one I recommend. And some weeks, there's a lot. But one that I think is an honorable mention is a Texas Hill Country mystery novel, book one in that series, Long Live the Queen, and it's by John Swank. And it's an also-ran because the first long part of the book is all relationship building and getting together. And it's not really a romance, but it's a relationship building. And the dead body shows about halfway through the book. And then the real mystery is the last quarter of the book. So since crime is not prime, it doesn't warrant a recommendation here. But the mystery at the end is pretty good.
And that's Texas Hill Country?
Texas Hill Country Mysteries, book one. And it's called Long Live the Queen. First, let me just say, the first three quarters, not only is it relationship building, but he studies ants at a PhD level. And there's a lot of discussion of ants. Now, not everybody is into that, but I could turn on a documentary about paperclips and I'd be fascinated by that. So I really liked all the scientific discussion of ants.
And sometimes when you don't think you're going to be that interested once you start it, it's kind of cool.
It's well written, and anyway, it's an honorable mention. Let me get on to today's book.
Yeah, actually, I want to stress one thing. I only have to read one book a week, because depending on who the guest is. So I'm lucky, but I want to stress again, Justine goes through a lot of books, folks. She doesn't just read one and say, okay, I'm going to promote this book. She really believes this is a good recommendation when she does one. I just wanted to get that in. Now you can speak.
Okay. Well, several weeks in a row, I'd gotten lucky with the first book, but last week it was a bit of a slog. So this is called Death Trick by Richard Stevenson, and it is the first in the Donald Strachey Private Eye novels, which have become legendary. Many have been made into some films, and they have spanned a lot of time. He just came out, with book 16. Do you know offhand, Brad, how far he's gotten?
No, but I can look it up while you talk.
Okay, that sounds good. So this is the first book. It came out originally in 1981. The version that's out there has been re-released in 2008 with a author's note on kind of looking back with perspective on what it was. He says that it came out in the spring of 1981, which is around the time that AIDS was starting, when they were still calling it the gay cancer. But this book is set in pre-AIDS times, and it's the only Donald Strachey book set in that time. So, as you can imagine, there are an awful lot of, overlapping relationships. So-and-so slept with so-and-so, slept with so-and-so, slept with so-and-so. And the bars and the nightclubs and that whole scene, which went away for a very long time. Donald Strachey has a boyfriend, Timmy. They seem to have no problem. They seem to be generally monogamous, but, occasionally step out, and that doesn't disrupt their relationship at all. So what happens is that Donald Strachey, every now and then in the course of the investigation, needs to sleep with a witness to get information out of them. The mystery this time is a very wealthy suburban couple in Albany, New York, hires him to find their son, their gay son, who has been accused of murder. And they are disapproving of his life cycle And along the way, Don gets suspicious of them and what their true intentions are. And what are the alternatives to jail that they have come up with that they're not sharing. And he's also pretty clear that the young man, Billy Blunt, has not committed this murder. And he runs into a lot of Billy's friends, all of whom think he has not committed this murder. I'm not quite sure what information he had to make that final click where he suddenly started, you know, he realized who the real murderer was and went out there, knew who it was and was going after him, convinced the police officer, sergeant, who has this antagonistic relationship, convinced him that this was the murderer. But at the end, when he tells you how he puts it all together, that makes sense. It's a very satisfying mystery. On this one, crime is prime. The relationships are all secondary. It's certainly not a romance. But it's interesting to see what the gay community was like in those last pre-AIDS days.
Yeah, and actually I can say this because when I had Richard Stevenson on as a guest, we talked about this openly. When the first novels begin, it is the very early 80s. And they did, it wasn't wild, but yeah, they kind of sort of hinted that they had an open relationship or there were troubles there and there. As the book progressed past the AIDS crisis, you saw much less of that, which is very true to what happened in society.
Yes. Yes. And that's why I think people need to look at this book in the context of the times. The mystery still holds up. The characterization of the various people still holds up. But that kind of carefree, don't worry about who you're sleeping with, has long since gone.
I did look, and he does have 16 books out. And he and I are in pretty regular, I'm not going to say we're buds, but he and I communicate pretty regularly. And he sent me an email because he was very excited. He has number 17 coming out probably next year.
Good, good.
It's being published by Emblem Press, which is the new press that is... Head editor is Michael Nava.
Right.
They're a subset of Bywater Books, which has been around for a while. So expect number 17 to be coming.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
And I love that series.
So that's all I have.
That's all you have. I've got Shane K. Morton on, and we had a lot of fun talking, so listen in. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Gay Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. My guest, Shane K. Morton, is a best-selling Own Voices author of LGBT romance, mystery, and young adult. Showing the LGBTQIA human condition in his work is important to him because visibility is everything. He writes darker horror mystery under the name Sean Ezensalt. Before writing novels, he was a playwright and musical theater actor who performed in all 50 United States as well as 3 countries. His films have played at film festivals around the country. He is married to his husband, and they have been together for 20 years. When not writing, Shane can be found at a film festival or singing cabaret in a dark dive bar. Welcome, Shane.
Welcome, Brad. Thank you, Brad.
There's no bar better than a dark dive one.
Those are my favorite kind.
You are the author of the Drag Queen Detective series. And you sent me the very first novel in the series, which is Men, Murder, and Makeup. June 14th, you have a new one coming out.
I do.
And this show will be on June 15th. So yesterday, Himbo's Homicides and Heels came out. So folks out there, you can start with the first book in the series, or if you want to jump into the new one, Himbo's Homicide and Heels. I love the titles of both of them. It's available now as well. And that's number 4, is that correct?
That's number 3.
Oh, number 3. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I hate to ask where people get their ideas because it's a difficult question to answer. And as authors, we get asked it a lot. And we get asked a lot on radio, TV, podcasts, whatever. But I have to ask you, when you came up with the idea, did you say, I want a mystery with drag queens? Or did the idea to write a mystery come to you and it just kind of led into drag queens?
Well, my very first book that I ever wrote was a paranormal college mystery romance. It kind of blended all of that together, and it was about drag queens. I've always had this, so I was a drag queen at one point in time. I helped pay my way through college by being a drag queen in the local gay bar.
That's awesome.
It was, and it was fun. And, being a drag queen, you're kind of like a spokesperson without being a spokesperson, especially in small town Kentucky. But you definitely are looked up to, and everyone knows your name, and, people come to the bar because you're there sometimes, right? So mm-hmm. I had this drag mother whose name was Raven Ravel at the time, and he was one of my very best friends. He took me under his wing in college and made sure that everyone treated me great because I was this little kid from an incredibly small town in Kentucky who showed up at a fairly liberal university and had no idea what was going on. And he just pretty much helped usher me through college, right? And then one day he helped me get in drag because I was seeing how much money he was making, and I was like, I think I could do this. So we did it. I looked like a cross between Bernadette Peters and Bette Midler if they had a baby together.
Yeah.
Which wasn't always pretty, but it got prettier. So when I wrote my first book, and like I said, it was a college paranormal drag queen mystery, but it was based on a lot of actual things that happened to me in college. And Raven, I used her original drag name, which was Ursula Moulet, which is, it's the kind of name you don't forget, right? Ursula Moulet. And mm-hmm. I used her in the book, and she's actually kind of crossed over into a lot of my books and into the drag queen mysteries. She's crossed over into the first two of those. That was kind of like the concept, like she was kind of the core nugget of thinking about it, because she keeps saying she's been in two other books prior to Men, Murder, and Makeup. And she's always involved in the mystery and is always saying, I have a nose, I have a sleuther's nose. Like, she's always the person who kind of pushes that mystery forward. And so the idea kind of came from her, even though she really is a supporting character in the drag queen detective books. But I guess you could say, Brad, that they came from life.
So in other words, like usual, you have no idea where it came from. It just, everything came together.
I mean, the drag queen mystery books, I was watching. I mean, in truth, I was sitting and watching Murder, She Wrote. And then a couple hours later, I put on RuPaul's Drag Race. And I was like, Murder, She Wrote with drag queens. I could use Ursula. And then when I started writing it, I realized that this wasn't really Ursula's story. So I went back and kind of chucked everything away except the core concept of the murder, and came up with the character of Victor / Raven Ravon, the drag queen in town, / Vicky Dean, her third personality, which is a reclusive mystery author that has become very popular very quickly. And Victor's kind of trying to deal with all of the identity is also one of those things that I like to write about. So he's trying to kind of come to terms with mixing and juggling all three of his identities and each individual personality that kind of comes with that.
Well, I looked back in the book and I tried to find the exact quote. I wrote it down and I lost it somewhere. So I couldn't find it. But I can tell you what it was. Victor said he couldn't do something that Raven could. And it had to do with personality. Like,
yeah.
Basically, Raven was more ballsy than Victor was.
Exactly.
What is the idea behind the different personas? How does that work?
Well, I mean, so when I was doing drag, I had a lot of drag queen friends. And I kept Shane and Shay, which was my name back then, very separate. Shay came out when I put the makeup on, and it happened only at the drag bars when I was performing. Rarely did I just put high heels and attitude on and go to a bar. I usually went to Shane. And Shane is a little, I'm a fairly robustuous human being. I'm a Gemini. But I do have that other side that likes to not be very people-y. And Shay always, I mean, Shay Black was a people person. Like, you know, she was there to please the audience. It's a performer thing. But I saw a lot of drag queens that I was friends with that their personalities that might have been here at one point, like, you know, Tom might be down here and kind of his thing, and Bobette is up here, and all of a sudden they all started to kind of blend together. And noticing that from some of my friends, that they've kind of brought their drag queen persona into their normal undragged life, that they still kind of took on a lot of those qualities that they had. And that kind of was the impetus of that. It, for some people, it's like, these are separate things. I do A because of A. I do B because of B. And for Victor, it was, I'm a drag queen one night a week when I MC the show. Most of the time, I'm Victor. I'm the hairdresser in town who really wants to quit his job and retire. And I'm a quiet kind of personal. And then there's Vicky Dean, who he didn't ever really get to be 100%. She was kind of this enigma in life at this point in time. And, you know, Vicky had done, you know, maybe some radio interviews and telephone interviews, but no one had ever actually filmed her, taken real pictures of her, except for a really far away cover on the jacket, right? Like, he didn't really know who she was. So kind of discovering that Vicky is this person, Raven mm-hmm. is this person, and I'm this person, you know. Identity is such a great thing to write about because it just leads you down the most truthful roads to me. So whenever I think about that question, it always kind of brings up personal baggage of my own that kind of winds up coming in the books, I guess.
It reminds me a lot of actors. It's very frequently yeah. that you hear actors say, I'm an introvert.
Yeah.
And I'm very uncomfortable being in front of people. And I don't want to, well, I don't know him, so I'm going to put him on the spot. Michael B. Jordan, who's very hot right now. It seems like he and Anthony Mackie are in every other movie there is out there.
Yeah.
I saw him interviewed last week, and he seemed like an absolute nervous wreck. And I thought of that. Now, maybe he was just having a bad day, but all I could think was, you know, he's not acting right now. He's trying to be himself. And
yeah.
There is a big difference.
I mean, acting paid my bills for 15 years before I moved to Los Angeles, which is hilarious, right? I came from the stage, so New York to here. And there really is a difference. You slide on the character. It's like some people use the costume to kind of figure out the character. Some people, it's all mental. Like, they have to write a 5-page treatise about their character or their character's childhood to kind of get into it. You know, it's different mm-hmm. for every actor, right? And I mean, that's kind of the same thing for me. It's, well, like now. So it's really easy when I was acting to just be able to drive the train forward. And as Shane, I'm a little all over the place and it's hard to stay quite on topic. But yeah, no, it's true. Actors are just, in the end, just people
yeah.
who got lucky. And most of the time, an actor is more introverted because that's why they're so good at figuring out and sliding on another character, you know?
I want to go back to, I want to make sure I got something you said correct. You started drag in Kentucky?
Yeah, I was a sophomore. I had been going to so the gay bar was 35, 40 minutes away from where I grew up. I mean, my town had nothing. It had churches.
Yeah.
and by the time I think I was in maybe junior high school at Walmart, and I got cable out on the farm when I was in high school. So I finally got MTV, right? So I drove, and I used to sneak in. I didn't have a fake ID, but, you know, a smile and meeting the right person to get you in can sneak you through the door.
Yep.
And when I was 19 is when I started doing drag. And I did it till I quit my senior year of college. So I did it for, like, maybe 2.5 years. And there was just too much going on after that. So I decided it was time for Shay Black to get her heel caught in a bridge and fall over the edge. And so I just put her aside.
Now, you say, though, that you're still doing cabaret. Is that in drag?
No. I haven't been in drag since, actually. Except for on stage. I have done it on stage for, like, a musical a couple times. But for the most part, no, I haven't done it. I've never revived Shay Black. She died to me. Like, when I decided her time was done, she was done for me. And then I moved to New York and started finding other characters doing that instead.
It's interesting to me that you said you were doing drag in the South. We were discussing a little bit before that I grew up in North Carolina, and I knew there were gay bars in my area, but I had no idea where to find them. But I took a trip to Atlanta, and I said, I'm going to go to a gay club. So this was back when the gay rags were actually in the racks.
Oh, yeah.
Sadly, don't exist anymore. And I picked one up, and I looked in it, and I found this ad for a bar. And it was,
do you remember the name of the bar?
I don't remember the name of the bar, but it was a leather bar. And I was on my way there, and I saw guys in leather walking up the street, and they scared the shit out of me. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to go in there. And I was really frightened by the whole idea. But I happened to stop right in front of a drag club, or at least a bar that was having a drag show. So I went in there and checked it out. And it was fantastic. I don't remember their names. They were hysterical, did great songs, and I absolutely loved it. And that was my first experience in a gay bar.
I think drag queens are a lot of people's first experience in a gay bar. I really do. It was actually a high school drag queen. There was this guy named Timmy, and he's dead now. He died late 90s, I believe. And we weren't like great friends or anything. We were in choir together. And I always kind of admired him because he was out. Like,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't in high school. I was still trying to hide, though very badly, to be honest. I mean, I didn't do a real good job at it. But no one really bothered me at my high school like they bothered my friend Timmy, because he was out and he was strong out. Like, he would take no crap from anyone in the hallways. Rednecks, jocks, it did not matter. He would, you know, throw his backpack at them and not think twice about it. And I always admired him like so much for that. And one day we're in choir and he was like, what are you doing tonight? And I was like, Magnum PI, I have no idea, you know, like nothing. And he was like, I know you're not out. And let's just be honest. I know you're a cis, right? And I was just kind of like, yes. And he was like, I'm taking you to the gay bar in Paducah tonight. And I was just kind of like,
I know where Paducah is. I'm surprised there's a gay bar there.
Oh, there was actually quite a few, actually. There's been a numerous amounts of gay bars in Paducah. And at one point, there was three. Now, I think there's one now.
I'm sorry, cut off your story.
No. So he just took me in to the gay bar. They knew him. We were like 17 years old. And he walked in drag, which I was mega impressed with at the time. He was gorgeous, like prettier mm-hmm. than any of the cheerleaders that we had in our high school who were all pretty, but he was gorgeous. And his name was Kimmy in drag, actually. I can't believe I remember that. And he walked us right through the door into Nirvana. I had never in my life experienced 17 years old. I had a drink in a bar, which was, you know, like for me, such a big deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of a sudden I'm making out with probably a 24-year-old college boy, maybe, you know, like I don't, it was a mind exploding night for me. It was amazing. And I went back numerous times after that just because I finally found my people, I guess. It's being from a small town.
That was your first bar experience.
First bar experience ever.
So it's your first bar experience. You had a drink. You were with a drag queen and you were making out with a guy. You jumped in the deep end.
I was a hoe.
Oh, hey, I've already talked a little bit about my background here.
It was crazy. It was amazing.
I don't regret that time. It was wonderful. I'm glad I have a wonderful husband now and that's passed in my life. I have no regrets.
That's exactly right. Me too. My husband and I actually met doing Shakespeare in a leather bar. So if that in Philadelphia.
Shakespeare in a leather bar.
Shakespeare in a leather bar.
And I do want to say, despite my fear of the guys in leather in Atlanta, I have been to many leather bars since then, and I have no problem with guys in leather. But we won't go there. I want to talk about drag in general. I think other cities are like LA. And yeah. I'm not going to say LA drag is dead, but it's really sick. And actually, one time I think it was dead. I'm going to give the listeners who aren't familiar with Los Angeles just a real quick geography layout. There's one side of the Hollywood Hills, and then you go on the other side of the hills, and it's the San Fernando Valley, where you've heard of Valley Girls. Well, I live on one side, and you go over the hills, and Shane lives on the other side in the valley. And I will say the drive from Hollywood to where Shane lives is a very short drive, but people in LA will make it sound like it's 300 miles away.
True.
The reason I'm bringing all that up is on this side of town, there was this outstanding place, Tommy Tang's, where the servers were drag queens. And they would just, I'm sure it was not as random as I recall, but they would just get on these shows and they were absolutely gorgeous. Just gorgeous. And I loved to go there. And I could not wait to take my daughter there someday because the colors were fantastic and all this sort of thing. Then over on your side of town was a place that was very famous called the Queen Mary.
Yeah, which actually, right before I moved here, closed.
Yes, it closed while I lived there. I used to live in Studio City, where you are. And they're both gone, and I don't think there was anything else. Now we have Hamburger Mary's, which does some drag events. That's in West Hollywood. And I think on your side of town, there's a...
not anymore.
Diva Royale. Did that exist at one time?
I don't know that, actually. Old Can Harry's was over here by me, but it just actually shut down.
Yeah, that's where my husband and I used to go dancing all the time. It absolutely yeah. rips our hearts out that it's gone.
But I know, it was so sad. It's the last gay bar in the area.
Yeah, it's really sad. I think we've lost 5 gay bars in Los Angeles since the pandemic started. But the whole reason I was bringing up these two bars and the disappearance of drag clubs... Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's a hard question because I think that even within our own LGBT community, you know, I don't want to date a drag queen, right? I mean, I was cute AF when I was younger, and so many of the guys met Shane and wanted to date him and met Shay and wanted to run away. Like, it was, we always eat our own kind, it seems like, sometimes in our community. Drag queens are this irreverent part of gay culture.
Mm-hmm.
And even sometimes put on pedestals and looked up to. But there's also that kind of, I don't know, darker side to the community that looks down on dressing up as a woman for some reason. I've never really understood that because I don't care. Be who you are and enjoy it. And it's no skin off my back. I'll let you be who you are. You let me be who I am, right? But...
Right.
I do think that that is, I think that that is a definite issue. And I think that being LGBTQIA became more okay within society, that having that irreverent part of the community almost felt like a boil. I don't know. I'm not sure of the right way to put that, but put the drag queens back in the closet until kind of RuPaul's Drag Race came back out. Like, there are some of the most amazing artists I have ever met in my entire life. And I work in the performing arts and worked in the performing arts all over the country for over 15 years. Some of the most amazing artists I've ever met, visual, performance-wise, dancers, singers, are drag queens. Like, mm-hmm. they need to be revered. Because what they do is not just... one kind of art. It's almost this all-encompassing art. I mean, the design, the makeup design alone. We're not talking about just throwing on some blush, some lipstick, and some eyeliner, and some fake eyelashes, and running on stage, because that's not what it is. I mean, there is a real art to drag painting. The underpaint, the highlights. You can look at RuPaul's Drag Race and just see what they do now. And a lot of those queens actually perform... you know, they all have their hometown bars that they're at, but a lot of them are actually at Mickey's in Los Angeles doing their showgirl show there. A lot of the bigger ones. And in New York, of course, doing their thing. But now I think that because of RuPaul's Drag Race, I feel like there's this kind of resurgence of respect that kind of went away for a little bit. And I felt like that was kind of in the late 90s, the early 2000s. But I think RuPaul's Drag Race has kind of brought some of that back, which I'm so excited by.
And I do want to clarify, when I said drag is dead in L.A., it's not completely dead. It, like in Mickey's, they put on shows. I know there's been some shows at the Abbey. But they're like special events.
Yeah.
There's not drag clubs or clubs that have them several nights a week. That's what's missing. But talking about RuPaul Drag Race, I think it has really helped. I also think it's really hurt. And I'm going to explain why, and I want to hear what you think of that. It's been on for 14 seasons, which is amazing.
Yeah. In numerous iterations.
Yes. The first 2 years, I absolutely loved it. And the reason I loved it, do you watch The Great British Baking Show?
I've watched some of it, but I've never really gotten into it.
Okay. It's staged like any reality TV show, but if somebody's, there is a competition, but if somebody's cake starts to fall, the others all run over and try to help them put their cake back together.
Yeah.
And the first 2 years of RuPaul's Drag Race was like that. If somebody's dress started to rip or they couldn't get something on right, they all got together to help them look right so they could perform the best they could. And I really enjoyed it then.
It was sisterhood. Yeah.
Yes. After that, it became the stereotype. I'm sure it's because it was more drama for ratings, but it became the stereotype, bitchiness, just virtually hate each other kind of thing. In that sense, I think it's really hurt the situation. Well, what's your feeling on that?
I mean, well, I think it got a little boring for me towards the latter seasons because they're the same, kind of feels like the same show over and over to an extent for me. And it feels like the drama has been hyped a little bit without need. Because what they captured in those first few years, I agree with you, was watching sisterhood unfold. They were competing, but one of the things that RuPaul says that always makes me laugh, this isn't RuPaul's best friend race, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's RuPaul's drag race. But I felt like that those earlier seasons, it was also about the friendship. No one was really trying to, for the most part, really get in somebody's head and make them fail. They were all supporting each other. But I will say that there is some truth to that. Even in the bar world, but especially in the pageant world. I mean, if you have never, if there's got to be a documentary about drag pageants. There just has to be. But it's like the Miss USA or Miss America pageant. I mean, they're massive things, right? A person from every, they have Miss Gay USA, Miss Gay America, Miss Gay Emeritus, Miss Gay Entertainer of the Year. Like, there's these huge pageants that have somebody from every state competing in one big giant pageant. And they are not nice. It is it is cutthroat. It is like showgirls. But I mean, you know, like it definitely, the pageant world and the bar world are kind of two different things. Like the pageant world is much more cutthroat, and which is kind of what RuPaul's Drag Race has become to an extent for me. Even though it's not really about pageants, it still has that kind of, I mean, it's the biggest pageant of all.
Yeah.
If you win RuPaul's Drag Race, there's a very good chance that you're going to be okay for the rest of your life. You might not make billions of dollars, but you're going to make money doing drag for the rest of your life if you want.
Yeah. I want to get to talking about the book, but I want to get out something that came to my mind that I just have to get out there. When you mentioned Jessica Fletcher and drag queens, my brain immediately went to Agnes Moorehead, dresses in Dora, in Cabot Cove solving crimes. And it stuck there. So
that's a beautiful thing, Brad. It's beautiful.
I had to get it out.
I always saw Vicky Dean as looking like a Midwestern soccer mom with a little more glamorous clothing because he can afford it. But you know, like, But yeah, I always kind of thought Victor as Vicky has to be incredibly fishy, as the drag community says, has to be very real. Like, she has to be able to go into Walmart and not get clocked by anybody that this is a drag queen, right? Like, this is this is just a woman in the neighborhood. And so learning, like, the way he gets ready as Vicky Dean is very different than the way he gets ready as the drag queen or anything like that. Like, there has to be that kind of difference to it. So, yeah, I've always saw her as a soccer mom with really great clothing.
I can see that.
The Agnes Moorhead thing, I love that.
So let's talk about your novels. And I don't know where you want to go. I read Men, Murder, and Makeup. Your latest book is Himbo's Homicide in Heels. If you'd like, you can talk about either of those two, or you can talk about the drag queen detective series in general. I'm going to leave that up to you.
Okay.
How do you like me throwing that out at you?
I mean, you throw it out. It's fine. I kind of write all over the place, to be honest, right? Like, I write a lot of mystery, or a lot of my books have mystery in them, even if they are more of a, you know, a romance book. I definitely have mysteries built into some of my Point Pleasant books. And Sean Azensault definitely kind of blends mystery and horror together with a little more kink, usually, because they're a lot raunchier than my Shane K. Morton books. But I think that when it comes to my drag queen mystery books, like, I've been really happy with the way that people are responding to them. I mean, I've been writing for 5 years. I used to put out a book a year, and then some fabulous women took me under their wing after my third book and kind of explained to me, like, I didn't even really understand that there was an MM romance community at the time. I thought I was just writing LGBT fiction, right? Like, I, you know, kind of romance, but I really had no idea. So when I wrote the drag queen mystery books, I wanted to make sure that romance wasn't really the through line for it, that the mystery was, because I had been writing a lot of romance recently. Like, the last 2 years has been, for the most part, 80% romance for me. So I really kind of wanted to just write something different. And gay cozy mystery, like, there are some. And there's actually more than people think, honestly. But you don't hear people talking about the gay cozy very much with some authors. But for the most part, it's, you know, darker mysteries and that kind of stuff. And I really wanted to write a cozy. And before I did that, I had to learn the rules of cozy mystery, because I had never written one before. And what I had written was so far removed out of the rules of cozy mystery. You know, I was showing bodies and blood and...
That's okay, but it ain't a cozy.
It's not a cozy. And murder, you know, cussing all over the place, right? And I kept the cussing because they're drag queens and you just got to get with it. Got to get with the time, right? So the drag queens cuss. Drag queens use colorful language. It's in the book. But the rest of it, I squished it all and rewrote everything. And once I really learned what the rules of a cozy mystery were, because cozy mystery readers will clock you if you are not following them. I mean, red herrings, the plot has to be able, all of the clues have to be in the book. You can't just say, oh, well, she found out something later. You know, like, it all has to be within the book, because they want to try to figure out the mystery themselves. And I love that about them, because that's one of the things I love about cozy mystery TV shows and reading cozy mystery myself, but definitely TV shows. I mean, I'm a huge Murder, She Wrote fan. I love that stuff. And I'm very happy that the books became something that people really love. And the second book, which is Diva's Death and Drag, which came out last month, is actually about a drag pageant in California. And the drag queens, all of a sudden, these attempts on their life start happening. And Vicky Dean has to step in and solve it. With Raven's help, because Raven is the MC of the pageant. So we have Raven involved in the pageant and Vicky Dean on the outside of the pageant helping with the cops, right? And it was one of the hardest things I have ever written in my life. 12 different drag queens in the book that are competing in the pageant, all completely different, and finding ways, I'm going to tell you, finding ways to kill a drag queen is fun. It's a lot of fun. I'm just going to say, I had the best time writing that book. I like Men, Murder, and Makeup. I was so proud of it when it was done, but it was 5 months of struggling with figuring out what it was I was really writing. It definitely took a lot of what am I doing? I'm not writing this book. I'm writing this book. I'm used to writing this book, but I'm writing this book. So, and then going back and making sure that everything that needed to be in the book was there. All of the clues, the red herrings. I had a blast writing it. I complained a lot as I was writing it, but I had a blast writing it. And the second book came like in a wave of joy, because I was so happy with the first book that the second book, I don't want to say it wrote itself, but like the plot and the mystery came so much easier to me because my brain was focusing on it. Like it was there. It wasn't in the romance world any longer. It was in this world, and I didn't have to really go back and do it because I was now doing it. You know, I was putting everything where it needed to be. And I will say the third book has been more challenging because I kind of am doing an homage to the Agatha Christie style of books with this one. One of my first plays that I ever... you know what? I don't want to say that, actually. I'll just say that it's an Agatha Christie style of mystery. And it is definitely an homage to a few of her novels. I mean, they're all trapped inside a European-looking chalet at the top of a mountain during a snowstorm, and they can't get out, and people start showing up, and things start happening. And so it's very Agatha Christie. And it's a little bit, it's not really a switch in style, but it is a kind of just a shift in genre just a little bit, right? Because her mysteries are really specific into what they are. And so it took me a little bit to kind of focus that where I wanted it to really go, but I'm very happy with the result eventually. So, and Vicky Dean is just a cool character.
What I find interesting, and I, everybody out there forgive me because I don't like to compare this to mental illness, but the dynamics between Victor, Vicky, and Raven is very interesting. And it's almost like we're dealing with multiple personality disorder. Because you have these different personalities working together and sometimes against each other. So,
yeah.
Interesting dynamics.
Yeah, I can see that. It's not written really to be that, but there is always that struggle with identity. I mean, whenever you become something other than yourself, right?
Right.
It's a part of natural life for every human being on the planet. You can't tell me that you go to a rich person's house who has servants and white gloves and you're served blah, 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 right, all over the place, that doesn't change who you are while you were there. You go to a red carpet event in Hollywood and all of a sudden you're a little bit more than you really are. You know what I mean? Like, there's always that shift of personality that we all kind of have whenever we're put in a situation that's different. I just kind of amped that up to 100 for Victor, you know, because he really does have to have three distinct personalities.
It reminds me a little of, I worked in the hotel industry for a lot of years. And at one time, a large part of my job was to wine and dine general managers of our hotel chain. And a lot of them were very upscale hotels in San Francisco. And I, you know, I would mingle the room, I'd talk, chit chat, and just fabulous. And then I would walk over to some of my employees that this was kind of a new thing for. And they're like, I want you to teach me. You're such a natural at that. And I said, natural? I fucking hate it. Every second of it. But, you know, I got to put it on. I got to put it on and I got to do the show because that was my job.
Yeah, it's what we have to do. And I mean, I think it's what everyone does. I mean, you're working at, you know, a giant hotel chain. Maybe you're the concierge, you deal with incredibly people who are used to getting what they want, or you're working at 7-Eleven and you come in and you got to deal with people who are used to getting what they want. Like, you know, like no matter what you are, I definitely have a different work persona at my day job than I do sitting around my house. Even that, the personality I have with my husband, you get me around my college friends, and boy, is there a shift. You know, like the way I talk changes. I mean, it's just, I mean, we all have to deal with those personality shifts. And I love writing about that, actually. And my YA books are really all about identity. I write about identity a lot when it comes to those stories, because I find when you're young, that sense of identity is more malleable. So you find yourself questioning who you are And I think there's such a strength in that, you know, like if you are open to that concept and idea that maybe I am not who I am perceived as, I'm something else. I mean, it's just such a fascinating side to a character. So I'm totally drawn to identity. Sadly, totally drawn to drag queens. I've been writing a lot of drag queens, not just mysteries, but even in, I have drag queens in some of my other stories too. I find them to be fabulous unicorns for me. You know, like they are the gift that keeps on giving. A drag queen's vernacular and their way of just looking at the world and being like, yeah, you know, it can be better. Let's just, you know, I mean, I just find it fascinating. So, and Ursula Moulet, who was in both the first of the two Drag Queen Detective books, was the character that was in my very first book, The Trouble with Off-Campus Housing, which is the paranormal college mystery romance. And then she had her own book 2 years later called Fault Lines, which is a mystery book. Did you ever read Tales of the City?
Oh, of course. Not all of them, but I'm working on it.
Oh, I love those books. And Armistead Maupin was like my first, you know, I mean, so I saw was that on Showtime or PBS? I saw the first miniseries.
It was on PBS, and PBS almost got shut down for it.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. So I saw it on PBS when it first came out, and I had never heard of the books. It was one of my first times, right, seeing LGBT characters on screen, that on TV especially, that really were just living life and being fabulous, just like any other character in the show. So I immediately devoured the books, everyone that was out at the time. And then, 10 years ago when he started redoing the older versions of the books, like these are the characters older now. Of course, I read all those too. So Fault Lines was kind of my love letter to Maupin's. Is like five different revolving storylines that all take place in a condominium complex, and how all of the mysteries start to squish together and intertwine. And Ursula Moulet is the lead character in that. She's kind of, I guess you would say, the Marianne from Tales of the City. And I'm going to write a sequel to that probably next year, I'm looking at now. That will be called Aftershocks. And then I plan on spinning Ursula into her own drag queen detective series, where she opens a PI, a private investigator business here in Los Angeles. So kind of taking the drag queen detective mystery and splitting it between Ursula and Victor, and having the same world, of course, and the characters can come back and forth as they have already in the first set of books. And we'll see kind of where that goes. I'm looking forward to discovering that myself. So
now is the time on the show. It's some of my listeners' favorite part. And I call it Awkward Questions Authors Get.
Oh.
And I interviewed dozens of authors and said, what are some uncomfortable, unusual, or just downright weird and rude questions you've been asked? And what I do is I spin the wheel and you get one of them.
Okay.
Okay. So you prepared?
I'm ready. I am.
Okay. Actually, I don't think this is going to be that difficult. Which book have you written that is your favorite?
So Private Waterloos is just a piece of LGBT general fiction written in third person. And I love it. It is the story of my life. It's incredibly autobiographical in some ways. And it's my favorite because I used it as therapy.
So it's not any type of genre fiction?
No, it's Southern Family. It's like a Southern Family story about overcoming the obstacle that you've never thought you would overcome.
It's called Private Waterloos.
Private Waterloos. It's just general LGBT fiction.
Sounds great. I want to thank you, Shane, for being on. And remind everybody, this is Shane K. Morton, the author of the Drag Detective series and his latest novel that came out yesterday. Depending on when you listen to this podcast, let's just put it this way. When you listen to this show, no matter when it is, the book is out.
It's out.
It's out. And it's Himbo's Homicide and Heels. So thank you, Shane, very much for being on the show. It's been a lot of fun.
It was my pleasure, Brad. Thank you for having me. It's fun just to talk to another author and have a good time.
Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend, too. Thank you for listening.